Accession number 27308, Reel 12.
Ronald Walsh, Reel 12.
Right, now, after Anjo, let me think now, came back, Anjo, that was 64. So around 65, we got back, I got back to, by then I'd been married 5 years, and I was getting towards the end of my time. The actual, I had originally also signed up again for another 5 years, which we called a fifth five, from 22 to 27, plus all the others I'd had on the extra 3 years, and this make-up when I was outside, I had to make all that up again at the end. That was another 14 months. I made all that up at the end, and what with extended short service, turning into long service, 12 years, then going out, coming back in again, extended service at Collingwood, 3 years, and then Pit Five in Terror to make it another. So I'd whacked up a few years then. I was beginning to get to the end of the time. So I came home and while in Victory, and then about 12 months, nice little job as chief of the footbridge in Whale Island. The footbridge to get into Whale Island was manned by a chief, and you had a guard box at the end. So I had a duty on shift work, mostly nights and all that lot. We worked four on and four off, or 12 off, whatever. So I had 12 months there on the footbridge of Whale Island. From there, I got another ship cropped up. I went to barracks, and after Whale Island, I went into barracks, and I was sent for by the drafting office, and they said, "We're going to send you to HMS Lynx in Bermuda." So I said, "Oh, yeah." They said, "What it is the Lynx is halfway through her commission, and according to the rules on the chief bosun's mate, if he wants, halfway through, can request relief." So he said the buffer on there, the chief bosun's mate on the Lynx, has requested to leave halfway through, so we're sending you out to relieve him. You'll pick the Lynx up in Bermuda, and he'll fly home, or come home. So off I went to Bermuda, on board the Lynx, a frigate, very nice, up-to-date, new frigate. And what we did there, we were on Cuban patrol to Cuba, you know, all that lot. At the time, it was pretty dodgy. They were trying to escape from Cuba into America and all this. So it was Cuban patrol. What we used to do is we'd go out Monday. We'd go out Monday and we'd patrol through the week, Cuban patrol, all around the islands and all that lot. And we used to come in a Friday, early Friday. And we would come into Florida, either Miami, Key West, or one of those naval bases there. Fort Lauderdale was another one. We'd have Friday till Monday in them. Fort Lauderdale, Miami Beach, or Key West. So I had 6 months of that. Very interesting, especially the time in Miami or Fort Lauderdale, whatever, where we had a great time there. With the American Navy, of course, you had all their facilities, you had everything. I finished off the commission out in Bermuda, and we steamed back to her base, which was Devonport. Went into Devonport, paid her off, and then I lived for about a week in Drake, HMS Drake in Devonport, and then I came back to Portsmouth again. By this time, it was 1967, more or less, bit middle of pitch 67, and I was due to come out in 69, March 69. So I reported to barracks, and they said, right, your job now is you're going to join the Belfast at Whale Island. You'll be based in the Chief's Mess there. You live in the Chief's Mess at Whale Island on the Belfast. And what you'll do is you'll have a leading seaman, and you'll be yourself, a PO, a leading seaman, and two or three ABs. And you'll have a boat, a power boat, with a crew. And you will patrol the reserve ships up the creek, up Fareham Creek. And at that time, there were a lot. A lot of famous names from World War II, ships, you know, and all that. Submarines, ships, everything. Cruisers, aircraft carriers, everything was bunged up there. And our job was more or less police patrol them. Because you've got a lot of activity up there where they were out the way, stuck up the creek. But they used to rowing boats used to go out to them, get on the subs or any of them, and any brass that was going, and there was plenty of brass, they used to nick the brass, and often in some cases, I'd go on the big ships and everything, and anything they could get into their boat they used to do, and we had to patrol to see that was. The danger was they'd get on a sub or something and they'd pull out parts and cause a lot of damage that had to be repaired. So I had that job for quite a long while. Nice quiet number in Whale Island on the Belfast, backwards and forwards, up and down the creek. And
what was the Belfast like at that time?
Quite frankly, she reminded me of the Glasgow. It's much the same. Oh, it's very important, very, very comfortable. It was a large, comfortable ship. But she was only in Whale Island as a base ship. Yeah, you know. I mean, I had quite an interesting time. I remember one Christmas I was Santa Claus. Dishing out the presents. Took my two kids there, you know. They dripped all over me because I gave them rotten presents. Of course, I pulled the first ones out. I got it because they were rotten presents compared with what some others got. But other than that, it was a nice, quiet number. And I lasted out on the Belfast then until 18th of March, 69. 18th of January, and 69. Then I went into barracks, finally. I'd done a lot then, and they said to me, right, you'll go outside 5th of March 1969. So I was only in there a while, and I went outside. By that I mean I went to Cosham. I was dished out with a civvy suit, a case, and a watch. I don't know what for, but everyone got a watch. Never got a bowler hat or nothing, just a trilby. And that was it. I was outside, finished. So I was then living, I still am living at Fareham ever since I was at Collingwood. I came back to Fareham and I had a bit of, I suppose I had a couple of weeks to see what I had to do. So I went up to the Labour office and clocked in, sort of thing, you know, for a job. About a week after, they phoned me up and said, look, there's a job if you cater for it, whether you'll get it or not, but there's a job at Collingwood, right next door to you, for a transport driver. So I went to Collingwood, I saw the transport chief. In those days, Collingwood had a big transport crowd of their own. We had a staff car, we had a fire engine, we had two or three lorries, covered in lorries, and we had half a dozen what they used to call the old tillies, and we used to fly around everywhere, Dryad, Mercury, all around London with the staff cars with officers, and we used to do two runs to, we used to do a run Friday night from Collingwood down to Talibon in South Wales with a 31-seater coach, 31 Matlows up behind you all the way down there, bawling and shouting their odds and all that lot, you know. Used to drop them off Friday night and then bring a load back. What they had there was the old railway station halfway up there on the Brecon Beacons. They'd turned into a sort of a sports activity centre. And they used to do, from Collingwood, the training classes, we used to take them down. They used to do a fortnight it was turned into, they'd built it up and everything else, and it was quite a nice sports centre, and they had a fortnight there, and then we would change. Every fortnight we'd go down and change them around. Another lot would go down, we'd bring the other lot back. And that went on. I was on the transport there for most of the time. I had one period where I was in the armoury with the armoury in Collingwood, shooting classes and all that lot, you know, as a civilian. And that was it. I stayed in Collingwood for 15 years. And retired altogether when I left Collingwood in 1969, on the 5th of March.
1969.
And that was it.
Now, obviously, you were in the Navy for quite a number of years. I'd just like to ask you, if I could, some questions about naval tradition and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Basically, one of the things that in the Navy is watchkeeping. Can you explain watchkeeping to me, how you keep watch aboard a ship?
Well, yeah. Mainly, you've got your ship's company joins the ship. Now, that ship has got to be at sea day and night. I mean, if you're travelling, say, from Portsmouth to Gibraltar or anywhere, or across the Atlantic, the ship's got to be manned 24 hours. So the ship's company is divided into watches. First to port, second to port, first to starboard, second to starboard. In other words, four lots, they divide a quarter up. So you're either first port, second port, or starboard port. So they're then divided into four, the ship's company. They're all trained men, obviously, if they're joining a ship. They're trained. So they'll be able to do any job, you know, that's in their lot. I don't mean down the engine room if they're not stokers, or MEs, as they call them today. But you have to be able to do what you were there for. So therefore, you could go to sea and say that the first port was off duty. In other words, they could go and turn in, and maybe the second port would be standby, so they were more or less free. And then you might have the first to starboard duty, so they would be the ones closed up, and second to starboard standby. That sort of thing. You got the idea that you're splitting the four. So that ship can be manned, fully manned, all the time, including the guns and everything else, because you obviously got gunnery ratings of all those branches and seamanship of all those branches. So you can have the first to port closed up and the others off, the second to starboard, whatever. That's how it was worked. As regards manning the ship at sea or in the harbour. In the harbour it didn't matter as much because you were all doing working daily jobs.
Did the watches have different names?
Well, what I said, first to port, second to port, first to starboard, second to starboard.
Well, I was thinking more of the watch periods then. Would they have different names?
On board? Oh, yeah. You'd have the... they'd be split up into... The day would be split up into the forenoon watch, which was 8 till 12, and the afternoon watch was 12 till 4, and then the first dog watches. Between the 4 and 8 were what they called dog watches. They were split. You had the first dog watch from 4 till 6, and the second dog watch 6 to 8. So you had all those, and then after the last dog watch, that was 6 to 8, you had the middle watch, the first watch rather, that was 8 till 12, 4 hours, 8 o'clock till 12, dog watches before that, and then from midnight to 4 o'clock in the morning was the middle watch, and from 4 o'clock to 8 o'clock was the morning watch. So you had all them watches, and each you closed up and into those. So you'd either be closed up for 4 hours in the middle, or 4 hours in the morning, or first dog or last dog watch, whichever. So they're all watches joined in with the parts of ship.
What about discipline on board the ship? Who regulates the discipline on board a ship?
Well, it depends on the size of the ship. Or, I mean, on a big ship, you'd have a master arms in charge of everything. He was a chief PO, he was a chief PO rated out, he was a master arms. He was the senior chief rating on board. And then the discipline came down from him. Yeah, on each part of ship, say, you had the PO of the of the starboard watch or PO. So you had the master arms at the top in his office, forget him. On the ships, you had, he was mainly regulation, you know, victualling and punishments and all that lot. But the running of the ship, then you had the POs of each of those watches. You had two, couple of POs of the watches. And you had leading seamen of them, so and then you had the seamen. So you had everything in all those watches, four watches, on that ship. On a smaller ship, varied. I mean, a little one that I had was 1801, was a trawler-type ship. And all you had there was the CO was a lieutenant. His first lieutenant was a lieutenant. And myself was the coxswain, and I had a couple of leading seamen, and that was it. So we ran that ship come up to the Hunt class minesweepers like the Coniston, Whiston. You had a buffer, and you had the captain, you had the first lieutenant, you had an engine room PO, and then you had the coxswain. Now on there, I was the coxswain of those two. Our jobs was on the wheel and all that lot, and also victualling, because on those ships, if you were canteen messing, you weren't victualled by the Navy. You were what they called canteen messing. In other words, it was my job to deal with the naffy in the base and keep the ship victualled through the naffy in the base, not the Navy. Are you with me on that one? And that was called canteen messing, and the coxswain was responsible for that. He would have to order the number of loaves he wanted, the number of eggs, but he also had a very experienced, usually a three badge AB, who was what he called his tanky, or the tanky was back the coxswain up. He knew what beef he wanted. He knew what the galley wanted. He knew exactly what was wanted. And more or less the coxswain had to order it with his advice and then pay for it, because the coxswain got money from the first lieutenant, and he went and bought the stuff with cash from the nappy. And that was totally different from where you just went and sat down with Navy Victualling, which was General Messfit then.
And discipline, how would that be dealt with on board if there had been a breach in discipline?
Well, all it was is... let's take a big ship. If there was an offence made, the PO normally that was in charge of that division would either be approached, and he would, if he thought it fit, he would charge the rating. Yeah, or if he wasn't, he would give him a rollicking, as we call it, and he'd let him off. But if it was serious, he'd charge him. If he thought he was to be charged, he'd go up before the master arms and he'd be charged, and he would be put in the report, and he would have to attend the captain's divorce or whatever. Usually, if he was punishment, it was captain's defaulters. That was everyone who was in the rattle would go up and get what they were due, whatever the captain gave them. If it was captain's requestman, then they would go and their request would either be granted or not granted.
And what punishments could the captain deal out on board ship?
Well, we had standard punishments, mainly number nines, what we called number nines. The captain would say, 10 days number nines. Now, number nines meant that you lost all shore leave, obviously, and you fell in the morning before the hands turned to. You did extra work then. You did extra work at 4 o'clock after the hands had finished, it had piped down. And in other words, you were available at any time. Then pipe men under punishment, you had to be there. I mean, you could be piped in the middle of the night, men under punishment fall in, and you could be used for any job they wanted done or anything like that. But in some instances, the duty PO of whatever watch it was, the duty PO would deal with them. They would take them on the shore if we were alongside, say, in ports or wherever, take them ashore, and he would double them up and down the jetty and give them a good old whack of that for an hour or so. But that mainly number nines, anything more important, you'd be referred to base.
Would there have been punishment cells on board the large ships?
Oh, on the large ships, yeah, they would have had what they call them holding. But just to put them in safe custody until they came up. They would probably, if it was a serious offence, they'd be dealt with in barracks.
Now, there are a number of traditions that we mentioned earlier. One of them is obviously Sunday divisions. What does that entail on board ship or in barracks?
Well, yeah, Sunday divisions was a routine, mainly for the efficiency of the service. Sunday was Sunday, and you attended a religious service, normally at sea or alongside. It was carried out with the captain, and if you had a minister on board, a priest or anyone on board, then a chaplain, as we called him, a naval chaplain, then obviously he dealt with the service, in which case you would all muster on the quarter deck, whole ship's company on the quarter deck, and the chaplain would have the service, and probably before that you would be all in your number one best dresses, and you would have a captain's inspection first. He would go through and inspect you, and then you'd have the divine service, after which you'd fall out and resume normal.
And what about periods of make and mend?
Yeah, these were given in the course of the day or the week or the period that you were either in dock or at sea. If you were at sea, it meant you weren't required. If you weren't required, they'd put make and mend. And that only included those that weren't actually on watch. So if they weren't, or say you went alongside in a foreign country, and you secured up, and they would say make and mend leave to so and so, which meant you could then go ashore on make and mend leave. You didn't have to work till 4 o'clock. It might be a Friday or a Wednesday, and you could have a make and mend. You could go ashore.
What will people do during the periods of make and mend on board ship?
Mainly get their head down. Not much else to do. I mean, other than, I never played cards, but I believe there were a few that had little schools of card players and that. Anything like that. But other than that, there wasn't much.
Did sailors have hobbies that they might carry out on board ship?
Well, I don't know about today. I'm not speaking today, but in my day, they did. They did have hobbies. Some of the blue-blooded males, they had their hobbies ashore. But those on board, I would say, they did map making, where they'd have a strip of canvas and they had an implement where you could weave a mat. And given all the time they had at sea and available time with nothing else to do, they could knock up some beautiful rugs and mats. It could be. A lot of them did do that.
Would they make model ships or things like
that? Oh, yeah. anything they fancied to do in their own time, they would do. Now in my case, I wasn't very energetic in that sense, but I wrote poems. I found I got a bit of experience out of that. And I used to write poems, war poems, you know, like when we were going to D-Day, Gold Beach. You didn't know, you got out there and you thought, well, what the hell's happening now? What are we going to do? And I would get out my book and I would say, well, you knew it was invasion. And I rattled off 50-odd poems during the course of my time in the service, war poems, which probably get published later. Some did get published in 1943. But that was my hobby. I mainly doing that, mainly because when I was submarine detecting, I could do that.
What about the crossing of the line ceremony?
Well, yeah, I've had several of them. It meant that when you were at sea on a ship and you crossed the equator or the line, it was laid on, there was a ceremony. You dressed up, all sorts of things, long nightgown and a false beard and all sorts of, painted your face all sorts of colours. Everyone on the upper deck mustered there, you know, and you were given a good old shaving with a wooden razor and all that sort of thing, and then you were dumped in a pool of water, or they put the hoses on you, and you had a real good, what they called crossing the line ceremony, and after which, once you cross the line, you got your certificate to say that you had crossed the line, and that was just a matter of tradition. It was a bit of fun, actually. Mind you, I don't know what they'd get up to today crossing the line, where they got mixed crews. I would think some things would have to be a bit restricted. I don't know.
And what about the rum ration? Can you explain the rum ration?
Yeah. It was always a policy, as far as I can go back, and a lot longer before that, that each day the certain members of the crew, obviously if you were a boy you didn't get it, but from the 18 you were entitled to a rum ration, where you got rum issued each day at 11 o'clock. The rum would be up, rum issue, and an officer and supply PO and the Wrens and all that would muster around the rum tub. The rum, the neat rum, would be poured into a big wooden chest, really, that was with God Bless the Queen on it and all that. And the rum was mixed there, and then it was, by that I'd say mixed. Now you say, what do you mean mixed? The rum is supplied, or was supplied to ships, in gallon rum jars, big round jars, and you always knew them. They were stone colour, and they were rum jars with the red seal on the top. And in them were neat rum from Jamaica, wherever they got it, but it was neat. And the lads weren't allowed to have neat rum. They had to have what was called 2-in-1. So when they mixed this rum, and by this I mean they knew exactly how many tots they had to dish out, so they knew near enough how many of the junior rates would draw neaters, and how many of the senior rates who were allowed to draw neat. So what they'd do, they'd mix up one container of neat rum to two containers of water. So much of that would be mixed, so you had one of rum and two of water mixture. That was for the lads, wrote down. POs and chief POs were allowed rum straight out the jar. That was neat. That was neat, so you got that straight out the jar. And you got that every day at 11 o'clock. There were a lot of mistreatment with rum. It was one of the, I would say, devious things in the Navy. Many a senior rate was stripped down to AB or leading seaman through misuse of rum. Like his mate would, dinner time when you got your 11 up, you know, his, two or three of his mates would give him their neat rum and he'd clue up flakers on the ground and useless to anyone and in the rattle. And